Growing up in East Columbus in the 1990s, Hanif Abdurraqib bore witness to basketball greatness. Players who rose to the pinnacle of the game and others maybe just as good or nearly as good who didn't. In his latest book, he explores the meaning of success, the notion of role models, the importance of community, and the power of the game he loves. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Hanif Abdurraqib will be at Joseph Beth Booksellers on March 25th to discuss and sign copies of There's Always This Year on Basketball and Ascension. He joins me now in this recorded interview. Thank you so much for being here. I absolutely love your book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thanks for making the time to talk.
Yeah. Your book is about so much more than basketball, but let's start with basketball. You've said you had a window into the world that was Ohio in the era of LeBron James as a high school player. How did you approach writing about LeBron James?
The way that I approached it was kind of by understanding that the book was not going to be about LeBron James. LeBron James is an adequate window into the book, but using LeBron James as a kind of window or entry point meant to me that, you know, he could represent himself or appear in the book in a number of ways, and none of them were beholden to the kind of granular biographical thing of LeBron James was born and did this and this and this. He, in some ways, is a metaphor for the book's greater questions around time and aging and what it is to love a place and stay in that place.
Yeah, your book talks about where you grew up, the pain and the joy you experienced, and the triumphs and disappointments you witnessed. When you sat down to write this, what's the story you really set out to tell?
Well, I think I wanted to be very transparent about my own anxieties around the passage of time. You know, I'm someone who I think, you know, I don't think there are wasted years, but there were points in my life where it felt like I was not living in a way that felt good. I was not thinking about the future because I did not dream myself of having a future at all. And so what that means for me is that, like, there's a real strong hold I have on the reality that my time now is valuable. I cherish it. I care for it. And I have also come to these revelations and realizations about how much I love and cherish my time much, you know, later than I would like to. So there's a lot of anxieties I have about linear time and the passage of it. And I really wanted to spend time inside of this book, not trying to regain the past or not trying to make peace with my past, but to maybe settle the score I had with the anxieties of my past so that I could live a more generous future.
The chapters are written as countdown clocks. Is that about facing that anxiety about time kind of head on?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. To know, I couldn't detach myself from it. You know, because those countdown clocks too are also really organizing the book around the descent of time. My hope is that it creates this kind of anxiety is a harsh word, but perhaps an anxiety within the reader. Makes the reader more aware of the time that is counting down. But also the way I wrote the book, hopefully, you know, I write in this book in a way that I hope demands a kind of close attention, looking very closely at small things or things that you believe to be small, but then upon looking for a while, you realize that they are large. And so the book is doing this kind of tug of war that is the tug of war of living for many of us, where we are aware of how time is diminishing. And at some moments, time diminishes us. But there is still so many things in the world worth our close attention. And if we afford our close attention to them, even as the clock ticks, it feels slower to us.
Early in the book, you write, quote, "You are in part who loves you," end quote. And it felt like you were talking about individuals, of course, but also entire communities and comfort, but also the heartbreak that kind of love can bring.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, it's an eternal heartbreak to be in a place. I mean, I know Cincinnati's no different and many cities are no different. That, you know, I've lived in Columbus my whole life, and that means that I've gotten to put down roots here, really affectionate roots, and be surrounded by people who love me deeply. That also means that love is enduring through massive material and architectural and geographical changes. And so the city does not always, in some corners and many corners, does not look the way that it looked when I loved it most. However, I think the real joyful challenge is that if you believe that a place's architecture is its people, then, you know, the people's love for each other can endure through these material obstacles of change.
There were parts of the book that felt to me like a love letter to Columbus, or at least the part of Columbus where you grew up. Did you see it that way at all?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that this book is, you know, I don't particularly want to leave Columbus. You know, I don't have any designs on leaving Columbus. I don't have, you know, I don't think about it much. And I know in Ohio, a lot of places, a lot of people believe or convince themselves, or maybe really truly do have to leave in order to make something of themselves, for themselves, to maybe confront some large desire. All these things make sense to me. But as someone who has never dreamed of leaving, I really want to afford a kind of dignity to this place. I really want to at least give people the opportunity to see it how I see it, to kind of lens it through my own looking, which is really steeped in a lot of affection.
I'm talking in this recorded interview with Hanif Abdurraqib about his book, There's Always This Year, on basketball and ascension. You write about your mother's death when you were quite young. How did that change your understanding of yourself and your place in the world, and even change your relationship with your community, or did it at the time?
Well, I mean, I think my relationship with the place and community is always evolving, you know, but gosh, when I was young, particularly when I was thinking recently about how I grew up in East Columbus, which is a neighborhood that is kind of segmented and in some ways a neglected corner of it is where I grew up. But it was bordered by Bexley, which is a sprawling suburb in a way, or I say sprawling not in terms of size, because it is also not that big, but it felt big. It felt like it was an entire, like the other side of the tracks, very literally. And the joy that I felt and still somewhat feel about my neighborhood that I had growing up and still have is that, like, it felt like my own kingdom. You know, it felt like a place that me and my people were, and that's, you know, so much of the book is trying to zone in and zoom in on the absolute pleasures of saying, this place is my place. This place is uniquely mine. And I do think that I try to spend my work and my living thinking about how to ascribe that kind of, this place is uniquely mine feeling to the city I love. So when I was young, I felt it the most, and I think I felt it most vibrantly. But as I age, you know, there's a real joyful challenge in trying to revitalize that.
You also talk about the way other people can misunderstand the place, which I felt was so powerful and so poignant. Was it important for you to really highlight that? I'm thinking of the sneakers thrown over the telephone line and, you know, some of those images that people interpret and misunderstand.
Oh, yeah. So I get asked this a lot, if the book is trying to ask people perhaps to understand the place, right? And I don't think that's true. What I actually do think is happening is that I am in some ways writing for people who know what it is to be from a place that is misunderstood. And so that is kind of the groundwork that I'm laying, is saying, well, isn't it a shame that people do not have the capacity or imagination to love this place as we love this place? And that's kind of, you know, where a lot of my work is, where a lot of my work centers itself, is on that central question of, isn't it amazing that we love this place so deeply and people refuse themselves the ability to understand it.
You also write about a time when you were unhoused, staying in a storage unit, showering at the gym. How did that change your relationship with Columbus?
Made me feel like in some ways the city was mine. You know, I would wander at night. The shelters were often overcrowded, and I could not get in them. And even if I could get in them, they didn't feel really safe for me. And so I didn't sleep. I would just stay up and wander the city at night. And I think the city, a city at night, it still intrigues me. You know, I don't know if folks, you know, I don't know how much your readers or listeners, not readers, apologies, know or understand about Columbus. But, and I don't know if it's Cincinnati is like this, but the downtown of Columbus just goes silent at night. And, you know, it's not, now it is a little bit more, but back then it was not like a downtown nightlife place. The nightlife exists elsewhere. And so I loved wandering downtown at night. I loved wandering neighborhoods at 3, 2, 3, 4 in the morning, because it felt like as the city slept and as it kind of folded into its silence, truths about it were revealed. During the day, if I was unhoused, it was like I was a nuisance. You know, I was either invisible or I was a nuisance. But at night, I could sit back and take a wide angle lens of the city and say, oh, there are places just by the way this city is constructed and built, there are places I am not meant to be. And I say I and not the unhoused I. I mean, the I is like a young Black person in a city. I don't know. I mean, that changed my relationship with the city in that I think I looked at it in a unique way. And I'm thankful for that. But also my relationship with the city evolves. It's nonstop involvement or it's nonstop evolution.
Well, I imagine that silence, too, just gave you some brain space to really think and reflect in ways that the noisy daytime city makes difficult.
Yeah. I mean, it's a, you know, obviously I don't want to glamorize that time too much, of course, but I did really cherish that nighttime experience. And also I have to say another thing that experience did for me was it made me love the people in this city who cared for others. There was a, and I think about this all the time. There was a person at the church in downtown Columbus. There's a church on off of Broad and Third, and he would open his doors, the doors of that church, every morning at 6 a.m. And nothing really got going in the church till 9 a.m. And he would let me and a couple other people just come in and sleep on the pews. Wouldn't bother us, wouldn't say anything, would just open the doors, let us in, wake us up at 9. And that was, I know that seems like a small thing, but that was the only sleep I would get. You know, that was the only sleep that I had the ability to get safely. And these small mercies stitched together make for survival. That is what survival is. And so I have a lot of gratitude for that as well.
Talking in this recorded interview with Hanif Abdurraqib about his book, There's Always This Year, on basketball and ascension. An important part of your book is the ascension of LeBron James. As you mentioned, you write about him, but he's almost a vehicle to write about all these other things. And you start talking about his dominance as a high school player, and you call out 2003 as the year he drove a Hummer H2 to high school. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about why you really highlighted that and what you think that says about how people view success, how some people in this country view who deserves success, and how they interpret that.
Well, I mean, that thing you said is the whole thing. You know, I was so interested in considering how people view who deserves to have material success. And the kind of rage that can come forth and anger that can come forth when people do not believe that someone who has material success should have it. And so I think for me, as someone who had very little for a very, very long time, and then I think some would agree and say correctly that I have material success now. And it is something I am puzzled by and I wrestle with at times.
What do you mean? You wrestle about whether you're deserving of that?
I don't know if the question is deserving or not, but I think it is puzzling. If I wrestle with that, I mostly mean I'm puzzled by it, you know?
Gotcha.
Because I don't think my life is, you know, my brain and heart are perhaps different by virtue of having aged, but my approach to living is not much different than it was when I was unhoused. I'm more resourced now, and so I don't have to go to the avenues I went to survive, but I don't know. Another reason why I took that LeBron James approach is because I wanted to get out away from the binary of deserving versus not deserving, because I don't know no one's really a fair arbiter of that, not even ourselves. And that doesn't mean, though, that at least for me, I don't wrestle with what it is to say I had nothing for a very long time, and now people look to my work and find something in it. And that is something to wrestle with gleefully and joyfully. And so when I think about LeBron and the Hummer, it seemed as though there was this whole contingent of people who believed he did not deserve to have that then, that soon, that quickly. And it was strange. It was strange to watch people. And quite frankly, it was a very, there was a very racialized divide of people who did not want LeBron James to flaunt his success, but enjoyed watching him do the things on the basketball court that made him successful.
You just mentioned that racialized divide, and that you do such a beautiful job of exploring that in this book. What do you think that says about America?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not optimistic, and I haven't been for a long time. I think that people are broadly becoming more cruel. And I don't think, you know, I think there are some doors that have been opened in terms of interpersonal cruelty as well as systemic cruelties, right? Like we can all, I believe, or not all, but some of us can point to the cruelties that we believe exist that are systemic and that are accelerated or decelerated or piled upon depending on who is in office where at what time, whatever, whatever, whatever. Yes. But the trickle down of that is that I am concerned about real material interpersonal cruelties that kind of seem to me to be accelerating. And some of this book was asking myself, you know, I talk so much in the book about enemies. I begin the book by talking about enemies, and that's a thread that runs through. And so much of that, that whole conceit and exercise was about asking myself to come to terms with the fact that I have sometimes in my life been an enemy to myself. And to know that is to know that I require grace. I have to afford myself some level of grace, or I'll never be able to survive. You know, none of us would. And to learn, to know that I have committed treason against my own angels, my own good heart, my own trying heart, at least, means that I am trying to do the work of learning to offer grace to others to a point, of course, and not everyone deserves our grace, to be clear, but to me, that is a way to at least combat what I think is a growing concern, which is the concern of the crisis of interpersonal cruelty that is born out of several crises, a crisis of increased isolation, a crisis of further division of binary thinking along political lines, all of these things. We have opportunities to operate against that within the worlds we build and the people that we can kind of physically reach and touch in those worlds. And so the book is trying to unravel that through this idea of centering the enemy and then asking myself to forgive and forgive and forgive.
You're a poet, and I think that's pretty clear just based on the way you talk. You've got a very poetic spirit that comes through, and there's such a poetic quality to this book. And I found after I finished it, I kind of had flashbacks to The Odyssey by Homer, which I'm an old person. I read that a very long time ago. Do you see this book as a hero's journey in any way? I mean, I guess whether that's the journey of LeBron James or your own journey.
Kind of, you know, it's funny you brought up The Odyssey, because that was kind of like a inspiration for me. And I think all the time about the way that I have been kind of conditioned to understand the hero's journey. And I don't think of myself as a hero, right? And I don't know if I think about LeBron James as a hero. To me, the place is the hero. Columbus is the hero in the book, in my mind, because it is the ever-changing, ever-evolving personification of a place that has a mighty task. And that task is to, or we can broadly say Ohio perhaps. The task that the place has is to live up to its promise enough to honor the people who have stayed and to properly afford a legacy to those who left, right? Be it LeBron or whomever else. And so it is a bit of a hero's journey, but the hero is not an actual person. And I think it is the personification of place.
I don't want to talk too much about how you write about the Cavaliers in this book, because I really want readers to experience that themselves like I did. But I will say there are so many ways that people typically write about sports, with heroes and glory and salvation. I guess I wonder, do you think it's fair to put that kind of pressure on athletes like LeBron James, or is it going to be inevitable, whether it's fair or not?
I mean, it's absolutely not fair, right? But that's what they, for better or worse, truly for worse, I think, and I say this as a very eager sports fan, that's kind of what sports fandom is, you know? Sports fandom is people living out their delusions in a way through placing these pressures that they themselves likely could not endure onto people who we are conditioned to believe can endure those pressures. I people who read the book, people who know me a little bit, I'm a very big sports fan, and I come to my sports fandom with a very clear understanding that sports fandom is absurdity, like truly absurdity. You know, there is only one championship, only one team can win it. And so for most sports fans, for 95% of sports fans, you're just signing up for heartbreak somewhere along that road. And yet you keep returning and returning and returning. I'm thinking about like Reds fans. I'm thinking about Browns fans. I'm thinking about just Bengals some extent. Fans. Like like when I was coming out, I don't watch the NFL anymore, but when I was very deeply in NFL, I was a Bengals fan. And like that was a unique kind of pain because I was a Bengals fan during this long stretch that I'm sure Cincinnati fans remember, and I'm sorry to bring it up, where they would like get to the playoffs and then lose in the first round. And so like that to me is a different kind of pain because there's a hope injected in you. You know, it's not like with love to the Browns, we all, you know, it's not like the majority of years you're like, oh, we have no shot at getting in the playoffs. That run that the Bengals had where it's like, okay, they're in the playoffs again. And then there's a disaster. You know, I will never forget the year that like Andy Dalton got injured and I would keep returning. And so what I love about sports, absurdities and all, is that yes, do people place unreal pressures on athletes? Of course. But there's also this romantic kind of sense of devotion. I think about that often, how sports really teaches me about devotion in the way to keep showing up, even when the odds have just rarely been in my favor. And I do think that can project onto my life in some ways, some good and some bad, but hopefully more good than bad. I think it is a blueprint for how to show up for people, how to show up for place, how to show up for community, no matter the results.
What did it mean for you last year to see the Lakers season opener with LeBron James and his son Bronny?
Oh, that was cool. You know, I mean, I know people have their feelings about Bronny, and I get it. I really do. But I also think that many of us, were we in the position to even remotely have the opportunity to play an NBA game or a professional sports game with our child, we would do it. I think most people would do it. And I thought it was also kind of sweet. It was a tribute to the longevity of LeBron James, which I think we're all kind of, at least I guess I can't speak for everyone, but I am in a moment now where I'm realizing I don't think we're ever going to see this again. Like, I don't think anyone's ever going to play this long again. Not in basketball. You know, I think other sports are different, but that really allows me a real firm appreciation for what I'm witnessing.
Well, I've been talking with author Hanif Abdurraqib about his book, There's Always This Year, on Basketball and Ascension. He'll be in town March 25th at Joseph Beth Booksellers to discuss and sign copies of his book. Hanif, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure. And again, I just absolutely loved your book.
It's been really wonderful to talk, and I can't wait to read there again. Cincinnati is a place I love very much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.